a great pleasure to introduce Professor M.N. Srinivas, who's going to speak on the social significance of religion. As you all know, Professor Srinivas is the doyen of sociology and social anthropology in India, being the guru of many gurus who teach here, including Andre Bittier, who was here during the last week. He's presently the chairman of the Institute for Social and Economic Change in Bangalore. Professor Srinivas started his career as a lecturer in Indian sociology at Oxford and went on to become the professor of sociology at the MS University, Baroda, and later at the University of Delhi. He was with the Institute for Social and Economic Change from 1972 to 79, during which period he also held the position of the Hardy Professor of Sociology, Hartwick College, New York, and Andrew D. White Professor at Large, Cornell University. Since then, he has been a visiting professor at the University of New England, New South Wales, Australia, National University of Singapore, Singapore. From 1986-87, he was Henry R. Luce Professor of Language, Mind and Culture at Wellesley College, USA. During the course of his distinguished career, he has been honored with the degrees of Doctor of Science, Chicago, Doctor of Literature, Mysore, Doctorate, Honoris Causa, Nice, PhD, Imphal. He has also received various fellowships from research centers in India as well as abroad. He has many awards to his credit, including Jawaharlal Nehru Award for contribution to social sciences, as well as the Padma Bhushan. Among the professional honors to his credit are being the honorary life member, South Asia Association, Australia, honorary member, American Philosophical Society, Philadelphia, president of Indian Sociological Society, president, Anthropology and Archaeology Section, Indian Science Congress. He has published many books on the subjects of caste, social change, and Sanskritization. Some of his latest publications are The Dominant Caste and Other Essays and The Cohesive Role of Sanskritization and Other Essays. Professor Srinivas.
Dr. Rajaramana, Dr. Kapoor, and ladies and gentlemen, I must thank the authorities of the National Institute of Advanced Study to give me a chance to speak to you this afternoon. Are you hearing me? Any difficulties? The subject of my talk, as Dr. Kapoor mentioned it, is the social significance of religion in India. I think I should mention just one or two points about it before I start reading the lecture. One is that 3 years ago, I received an invitation from a Swedish cultural organization to write a piece on this very topic. They specified that I should write on the social significance of religion and that others would be writing about other aspects of religion in India. I think that's a very important thing to remember. I only talk about social significance of religion. I do not talk about religion as a worldview, religion and the human condition, or nor do I enter into any technical analysis of Hinduism or any other religion present in India. So, my field is very limited. And please remember, it was written for a foreign audience. So, as I go along, some of you might feel he is telling us something we all know. And I apologize to you for that. But I might also, if I may, mention to you that there are a few things in it which I think are not very obvious. And maybe that will give us enough material to discuss after I have read my lecture. In fact, I am looking forward very much to the discussion. I find reading my own writings slightly boring, but I prefer reading to extemporizing, because extemporizing, you know, one can go on and miss the focus and get into digressions. This is this is a focused piece, and let me now start reading. India is a multi-religious country with the followers of every great religion living in it. But the overwhelming majority, about 80% of Indians, are Hindus, and Hinduism has colored every other religion in the country, including Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Sikhism, and Jainism. Religious diversity is, however, only another expression of the great cultural diversity of the region of South Asia. India is culturally more diverse than, for instance, Western Europe. And this is compounded by stratification along the lines of caste and class. I have some competition out there, but I hope you'll ignore it, you see. How has Hinduism colored other religions in India? In the first place, by caste. Caste divisions are not confined to Hindus, but exist also among Christians, Muslims, Sikhs, and Jains. More specifically, even though Islam and Christianity claim to be egalitarian in outlook and creed, in India, both have caste divisions among them. For instance, converts from the former, or rather ex-untouchable castes, to Christianity generally sit segregated during weekly prayers, particularly in the rural areas. Neither does conversion to Islam always dissolve caste. For instance, the Hindi-speaking weaving caste of Julaha have not shed their status as untouchables even after conversion to Islam. In fact, generally speaking, in North India, where Islamic penetration has been deeper and more widespread than in the South, caste endogamy and caste-wise specialization of occupation continue long after conversion to Islam. Hinduism is regarded as a tolerant, within quotes, religion, both by its votaries and others, and it is common to attribute such tolerance to scriptural sources or religious sources. One of the most famous of his states, I'm translating, truth is one, but sages call it by many names. As is well known, there is a deep pantheistic streak in Hinduism, and the idea that God is everywhere favors tolerance, not only towards the great world religions, but towards tribal and peasant religion and belief. However, monotheism occurs in Hinduism at the sectarian level, and it is usually accompanied by intolerance towards other sects. But there is also an institutional underpinning to tolerance, and that is provided by, strangely enough, caste. It is true that at the level of individual castes, exclusivism is the rule. But if one looks at the system as a whole, as distinct from individual castes, an acceptance of diversity in lifestyles lies at the heart of the system. However, the price for this acceptance is an acceptance of hierarchy. But that does not mean that the group that is included in caste hierarchy, in caste society, is always relegated to an inferior position. More commonly, the included group's status is ambiguous, it claiming a high status while its neighbors regard it as low. Ambiguity with regard to group status is a common and essential feature of the caste system at the local level. I regard it as a fundamental feature of the system, but I won't go into it here. Historically, there have been instances of immigrant groups who came into the country and captured power and followed it up by claiming Kshatriya status for themselves. This has also occurred in the case of several tribal groups and peasant castes which happened to capture political power at local levels. It would not be unfair to state that those who had power, whatever their origins, were generally able to claim the status of Kshatriyas. One well-known historian of India has gone so far as to state that there have been no true Kshatriyas after the 5th century BC. This brings us to the Hindu method of tribal absorption. For a period of time, decades if not centuries, tribes could become castes, the most favored among them becoming Kshatriyas. There was also another route to caste society. In the frontier areas of Hinduism, tribes occasionally used the model of the Varna, Vedic fourfold hierarchy of the Varna system, to regulate their mutual relations. This seems to have happened, for instance, in Kumaon in the north and the Nilgiris in the south. This naturally led to the proliferation of caste systems in different regions, though underlying all the varieties were such common factors as the attempt to squeeze the numerous jatis, local endogamous groups, of each region into the Varna system, purity pollution ideas, and the caste-wise specialization of occupations. Our knowledge of traditional Indian society has increased considerably during the last 40 years or so. And as a result, we now know that caste system did permit of a certain amount of mobility for hereditary groups. We also know that such mobility had its source in the fluidity of the pre-British political system at its lower levels, in the availability of marginal land for cultivation, in the conversion to the Protest Bhakti sects, which arose continually since the 6th century AD in various parts of the country, and finally in emigration followed by change of occupation. An important result of mobility was a change in the culture, ritual and lifestyle of the upwardly mobile caste or other group in the direction of the culture of the higher group that was emulated, generally one of the twice born jatis, Brahmin, Kshatriya or Vaishya. This is the well-known phenomenon of Sanskritization, which had several dimensions to it, religious as well as secular. Such emulation generally resulted, among other things, in the adoption of the worship of the great gods and goddesses of Hinduism, Vishnu, Shiva, and their consorts and offspring in their many manifestations and forms. It also led to the transformation of purely local godlings into one or other of the great gods. Emulation also enabled such theological ideas as samsara, that is rebirth, karma, the idea of desert, dharma, moral and religious rules, punya, merit, papa, sin and moksha, salvation, to spread among the emulators. The life cycle rituals, calendrical festivals and other customs and habits of the model group were also borrowed by the emulators over a period of time. Emulation also resulted in the imposition of a puritanical code of conduct on women, to their confinement within the four walls of the household, and in the case of widowhood, to lead a despised existence. The conjugal relationship took on a religious character, the husband being deified. While the model group was Brahmin or Vaishya, the emulators had to become vegetarians and teetotalers. The services of a Brahmin priest were indispensable for all this. The emulating group was generally able to produce, over a period of time, a myth which enabled it to claim a new and higher caste identity, clothed in Varna terms. As mentioned earlier, Protest sects or Protestant sects have been a feature of Indian society ever since the 6th century AD, if not much earlier. Such sects have rejected Brahminical claims to supremacy, the inequality of caste, the religious inferiority of women, the prominence accorded to Sanskrit over the languages actually spoken by the people, the excessive importance given to the performance of complex ritual and of esoteric knowledge for achieving one's salvation, etc. Paradoxical as it may seem, the use of ordinary languages of the people for religious purposes, the advocacy of a single-minded love of God as the simplest means of achieving salvation, and the general anti-elitism of the bhakti cults greatly enhance the spread of ideas associated with Sanskritic or higher Hinduism. The Hindu sects founded by the great Brahminical theologians of the South, Shankara, Ramanuja and Madhva, and the bhakti cults were all proselytizing faiths, at least in their initial phase. The bhakti cults in particular carried their faith to the members of the lower caste, so-called lower caste, including in a few cases the untouchables and women. A few sects had quiet saints from among the lower castes and women. However, the phenomenon of the emulation of the culture and lifestyles of the higher caste does not make sense without reference to the idea of dominant caste. Dominant castes occur everywhere in rural India, though they are more visible and powerful in some areas than others. Dominant castes generally have a high local status, own a considerable quantity of local land, enjoy strength of numbers, wield power over the other castes living in the area, in particular the untouchable castes, which provide them with agricultural labor and also perform a number of menial services. The dominant castes emulated the culture and lifestyle of the royal caste in power in the nearest town, while they themselves acted as models for the other castes living in their areas. They emulated royalty while the other local castes emulated them. In the latter role, that is, as providing models for others to emulate them, they acted as mediators of the higher culture of Hinduism for the emulators. They were also a protean source for the parochialization of the higher culture of Hinduism in different parts of the country. In what may appear to the Sanskritist Indologist as a scandalous disregard of the sacred texts, parochialized versions of myth and ritual appeared in different parts of the country, testifying to the creative powers of folk Hinduism and often bearing little resemblance to the originals. But during the last 150 years, and particularly during the years since independence, the factors making for standardization have gained great ground as a result of growing urbanization, the spread of education, and the revolution in communications. The last four decades have been marked by the emergence of new group identities. For instance, cognate subcastes have merged together in order to have greater access to power, education, and the professions. The same process is occurring among tribes and ethnic and religious minorities, with some tribes such as the Khasis, Nagas, and Mizos, their strong sense of group identity and their geographical location have both result in their forming distinct states, and there are also demands for the formation of a distinct state from some other tribal groups in eastern India and Bihar. Such demands are, however, radically different from the demand of a section of the Sikhs for the formation of a sovereign and independent Sikh state to be called Khalistan. During the last 20 years or more, Sikh self-consciousness as well as Sikh fundamentalism have been on the rise, and their demand for an independent state has received considerable encouragement from affluent Sikhs settled in the UK, USA and Canada. Mention may also be made here of the rise of Islamic fundamentalism the world over, and Muslims in India too have felt its impact. In their case, fundamentalism is exacerbated by the feeling that they are a minority and that they are not getting their rightful share of power, government jobs and seats in educational institutions. Of late, they also seem to be feeling that their cultural and religious autonomy is threatened by militant Hinduism and paradoxically by secularists and liberals who wish to impose a common civil code on all Indians. In this connection, the fact that Pakistan is an Islamic state determined to go even more Islamic only compounds the problem. This brings us to politicization, which is an important and pervasive process in post-independence India and becoming even more pervasive each day. It is, however, a part of the much wider process of secularization, but deserves to be mentioned on its own. Every activity tends to be affected, some would say infected, with politics, religion not excluded. In the foregoing paragraphs, we concluded how caste, ethnic and religious groups were seeking to find expression for their newfound identities and also obtain greater access to scarce resources. This inevitably brings them into conflict with other similar groups engaged in obtaining access to greater resources, and in very few cases with state and central governments. The net result of all this is to further step up politicization, and this is symbolized by the ubiquitousness of the politician in modern India. He is called in to preside over all sorts of events, from seminars held by academics on esoteric topics to sports and cultural events, and to be an important guest at the weddings of the elite and at the inauguration of Vedic sacrifices, temple processions, etc. Holy men in ochre robes seek his company in an effort to solve the problems confronting their disciples and organizations. In short, the politician has almost become the legitimizer of public events in modern India. A significant result of the operation of the above processes has been to erode the syncretistic character of Hinduism, though shreds of it still remain in a few local pockets. Traditionally, Hindus did not consider it religiously wrong to offer worship to the sacred objects and deities of other religions. Thus, Hindus visited the graves of Muslim saints and took part in the Muharram procession, visited Sikh Gurdwaras, made votive offerings at Catholic shrines. Hindus and Jains had connubial, marital relations with each other, caste being more significant for endogamy than sect. While Hindus were far more prone to syncretism than the others, the latter were not unaffected by the Hindus. In the villages, Muslims occasionally participated in the festivals of Hindu deities and more rarely even made votive offerings to them. The original Sai Baba of Shirdi in Maharashtra, who is worshipped by thousands of devotees, Hindu, Muslim, etc., was a Muslim by birth. It is appropriate to remark here that one of the results of the political developments in India during the first half of the century was to prize minority groups, and in particular Muslims, out of the local communities in which they were encysted, and to integrate them with their fellow religionists elsewhere in the subcontinent. The creation of the sovereign state of Pakistan was an understandable consequence, and that in turn gave birth to Bangladesh. Traditionally, the caste analog enabled groups with diverse cultures and lifestyles to coexist, as instanced by the Parsis of Gujarat. They originally came to India in the 10th century AD as refugees fleeing Islamic persecution in their own country, in their home country. The Hindu king of Kalyan welcomed them, just as the Zamorin of Cochin welcomed Jewish refugees 3 centuries later, and they have lived ever since in Western India, practicing their faith, a small island of Zoroastrians amidst a sea of Hindus, Muslims, and others. Foreign missionary writings have characterized Hinduism variously as, within quotes, otherworldly, life-denying, pessimistic, and fatalistic, while Indologists who studied Hindu scriptures and theological writings were impressed with Hindu preoccupation with salvation and with Hindus' high philosophic character. Educated Hindus, on the other hand, like to think of themselves as spiritual and of Westerners as materialists, though one hears less of this rhetoric now than in the years before independence. Contrary to the above representations, the sociologist of religion finds that one of the reasons for the survival of Hinduism is its intimate linkage with the perennial concerns of the people. Even today, 75% of Indians live in villages and their livelihood is linked directly or indirectly to agriculture. Every agricultural activity, from the first plowing of land to harvesting and storage of grain, is marked with ritual. The occurrence of rain at proper times and in appropriate quantities is an anxious concern of the people, and there are deities to whom one may pray for rain. In South India, there is an annual festive thanking of cattle for their part in the production of food and fodder. There are deities whose propitiation is regarded as essential for keeping out such dreaded epidemics as smallpox, plague, and cholera, and for protecting the health of newborn infants and their mothers. Pilgrimages are undertaken to certain shrines, including in some cases one's own lineage deities, in the hope of obtaining children, particularly sons. Pilgrimages are popular with members of all religions, and they are undertaken to attain a variety of goals. First, there are the great centers of Sanskritic Hinduism, such as Haridwar, Prayag, Benares, and Gaya, which are visited by thousands annually to wipe out their sins and increase their stock of religious merit, and to propitiate the spirits of departed ancestors. There are also regionally important shrines such as Tirupati and Shabarimala, which are visited not only for earning merit, but for thanking the deities for having bestowed such favors as granting a son, passing an examination, getting a job, etc. About 15 years ago, I looked into the annual returns of the Tirupati temple. It was about 20 crores or so. Now I think it's nearing 50 crores, you see. This will give you a crude idea of the popularity of the Tirupati temple. As mentioned above, pilgrimages are not only popular with Hindus, but with Jains, Sikhs, Catholics, Buddhists, and Muslims. A few famous Sikh shrines are in Pakistan, while the most famous pilgrimage centers for Catholics and Muslims are outside India. Buddhist pilgrims come from all over Asia to visit Buddha Gaya, Sanchi, and Benares in India, and Lumbini in Nepal. The renouncer, that is the sannyasi, in ochre robes, is a familiar figure in Indian towns and villages, and large numbers of them can be seen in pilgrimage centers in the vicinity of great temples and on the banks of sacred rivers. When a man was seized with the urge to seek his salvation, he sought out a teacher to guide him in his search. It is almost axiomatic that the search for salvation cannot be undertaken without a guru. The search generally takes a long period of time, and not everyone is successful in his search. It is up to the successful sannyasi to stay a recluse or return to the people to teach and guide them. If he decides on the latter, then he has to be peripatetic, not spending more than 3 nights in any single place, and leave an alms beg from not more than 7 homes. On the other hand, a sannyasi may found an ashram, a house or a cluster of huts, usually at some distance from a village or town, where he lives with a few disciples. He teaches his disciples during the day, and in the evening there may be group prayers or a discussion or discourse on matters religious. Visiting holy men is a popular activity with all Hindus, and even merely seeing them is believed to confer merit on the visitors. It is also open to a potential renouncer to join an established monastic order, traditional or modern, such as the Ramakrishna Mission. Sectarian Hinduism, ever since the days of the 9th century reformer Shankara, has established monasteries providing places to which potential renouncers can turn. The first monasteries in India were established in India by the Buddhists and Jains circa 6th century BC. During British rule, several religious organizations were founded in different parts of the country to rid Hinduism of the many evil customs associated with it for the promotion of education and social reform. Space does not permit me to go into detail, but one such organization, the Ramakrishna Mission, founded by Swami Vivekananda, is one of the best known and has as its aim the propagation of a modern and activist version of Hinduism. It is engaged in a variety of cultural, educational and social welfare activities and has branches in cities throughout the world. The Ramakrishna Mission, modeled after the European Christian missions of the 19th century in India, has itself provided a model for numerous other Hindu organizations. As a result of 2 centuries of contact with the West, the activist streak in Hinduism is receiving great emphasis, the Bhagavad Gita becoming the single most important book of the Hindus. Heads of religious institutions, traditional and modern, are now engaged in running schools, colleges, hospitals, etc. Early in 1986, several heads of traditional monasteries in Karnataka and South India issued a statement to the effect that the practice of untouchability was contrary to the tenets of Hinduism. This statement was in a sense revolutionary and was also a symbol of the ability of Hinduism to come to terms with the forces of change. Hinduism is also undergoing other significant changes which can only be listed here. The ideas of purity and pollution which permeate a daily life, life cycle rituals and intercaste relations, particularly for the higher caste, are rapidly weakening, especially in the urban areas. This may precede the emergence of a form of Hinduism that is increasingly caste-free, a movement which is also supported by the cult of the new godmen and certain other developments in urban Hinduism. Incidentally, urban Hinduism is as neglected as it is important and is a source of new ideas and new movements in Hinduism. Yet another change is the appearance of militant forms of Hinduism, partly and only partly in response to the evangelical activities of missionaries among Harijans and tribals, and to the appearance of separatist tendencies among religious and ethnic minorities in India. But basically, Hinduism, with caste and the worship of many gods and goddesses, and its pristine syncretistic bend, is a live and let live religion. And this may be still seen in some local festivals and pilgrimages. Also, at the local level, particularly in rural areas, people not only belonging to different castes and other ethnic groups, but to different religions, are economically and socially interdependent. In such interdependence lies the best hope of coexistence. Now, I have made a few points. Some of them may be provocative or unacceptable to you, and I am looking forward to the discussion that now is going to take place with as much keenness as you people, I hope. Thank
you. Incorporated, there were incursions of different arms, etc., from Yavana and so on, who were coming into the Middle East. Why was the reason that where God, I mean, the later beliefs and God, civilization God, were not incorporated in the Hindu temple?
This is a difficult question to answer. You know, a God survives if he performs a function. If he doesn't perform a function, he doesn't survive. Particularly in agricultural societies or cultures, if I may elaborate this point, when I spent a year in Rampurai village, 22 miles from Mysore on the bus route, I discovered, I mean, when I analyzed the religion and ritual of the people, most of them peasants are dependent on agriculture. I discovered that the great god Rama, who has become a center of great controversy in India today, was important but quite marginal to the needs and to the activities of the people. The more powerful gods, one of the most powerful there was the deity called Basava. Basava is the Nandi bull. It's a local name for Nandi bull. He was so important. One of the reasons being, he was intimately related to the occurrence of rains in proper season, and rains are vital. That he was also a symbol for the peasants' association with cattle. You know, it's a very intimate and deep relationship. And I found Rama was, if I may put it exaggeratedly, falsified a bit to make almost irrelevant, except that the headman of the village, his family were devotees of Rama. I regard it as something which they had taken over from the Brahmins. For Brahmins, Rama was very important. But for the peasants, he remained indifferent to their day-to-day concerns, just as Basava was very important. And also, very important, particularly in the years before inoculation and vaccination took place, Mari, the village goddess in various forms, and Kali and so on. So, you can ask the question which you have asked now, even of the various Vedic gods, you see. Indra, Mitra and Varuna, where are they now? And Rudra was almost replaced by Shiva. Brahma has dropped out. So, why ask questions about the Middle East? I'm not saying what you asked is irrelevant, you see. No, certainly not. That even early Vedic religion underwent a metamorphosis as it adjusted itself to the needs and necessities of the emerging society of India. I don't know if I'm satisfying. To answer. The first half I can say, gods are fashioned in the image of human beings, not in an individualistic sense, in the image of their culture, you see. I mean, I felt this very strongly when I was studying Rampura, that, you know, the way in which God was fused with the concerns of the people, agriculture, rain, famine, drought, epidemic diseases and so on. So, certainly, God has to, I don't want to be mechanistic, I am not saying this the whole of religion, that I want to repeat all the time, but I think the religion of any living people, whether it's of Arabs, Bedouin Arabs in the Middle East, or of agriculturists here, or of the Australian Aborigines, you see. What is religion? I know a little. They're all related intimately to the needs and necessities of the people as a whole.
On a functional basis, one doesn't really see why there is a presence of a female deity in one area and the male deity in the area.
You know, I have to speculate now. I'm not on the area of firm fact. I would see the picture slightly different from you, subject to correction, you know. I think the basic thing in the whole of South Asia, I would say, is the cult of the village goddesses. I don't know whether it goes back to Mesopotamia and so on. I'm not projecting a historical thesis. I think this is the underlying thing. In South India, for instance, the cult of the village goddess is fundamental. And she's known as Mari here. And in parts of Andhra country, Yellamma. And she's, you know, and various gens. And in Kerala, Bhagavati and Pobedi and so on. And this goes right all over India. And there is a cult of seven sisters here, but that is more articulated than really practiced. They would like to systematize it that way. But I would say that the cult of the village goddess is a fundamental substratum of South Asian religion. And this was also so in Mesopotamia, I'm told. But anyway, let that aside. Over that has been laid the cult of Rama and Krishna and Shiva, you see. And then the Vedic deities have lost grounds. Rudra has become Shiva. And Vishnu has certainly, you know, I think even Vishnu is much more popular as Rama. Krishna, you know, they're all, you know, the whole theory of avatars. There are certain, you know, synthesizing mechanisms. I mentioned pantheism as one, you see. You know, that the idea that there is a deity in everything is a synthesizing mechanism. And the other thing, the idea of avatar is a synthesizing mechanism to make even Buddha the avatar of Vishnu, you see. And maybe a century later they will say Gandhi was an avatar of Vishnu. So, you know, this is how Hinduism absorbs newer forces and so on. So I wouldn't say that in the Hindi belt, male gods are, certainly they are very, very visible. Their ritual takes up a lot of time. But, you know, before vaccination and inoculation came, the village goddesses were very, very important. I would refer you to the reports of the early British ICS officers and so on, you know, tribes and castes of Uttar Pradesh. I think I have got the entire set in my house, Nesfield and in O'Malley, and for South India, Thurston and Rangachari, for Western India, Enthovan, for Bengal, Dalton. And you go through the gazetteer reports. You are Dr. Mr. Chakravarti, aren't you? Chatterjee. You go through them, and under as a substratum, they all occur. And I may even tell you that when the Rajput Parvenos, you know, all these people who acquired some land in Rajasthan and became princelings, one of the first things they did was to send for a Bengali priest, you see, and have a Kali temple enshrined, and the Bengali priest would say, sacrifice for a black goat is essential on every day or Saturday or something, you see, or Tuesday, and they would, I mean, this part of the process of legitimizing themselves as Kshatriyas, you see. So, I think it is a fundamental substratum of Hinduism, which is losing ground thanks to the development of communication, development of modern knowledge, and to vaccination and inoculation.
Smart.
Yeah,
Professor,
sometimes ago, the concept from that the intention of influence God into our concept of worship, basically it means by human being. Now if you look at, say, for example, we have Lord Sudhama, then we have Lord Village. Originally it is a debate of what God assumes the shape of a living country. And then we have God's Ayyappa, like, and by the origin is one God assumes, a male God assumes the female form, and then produce the fact. What is the need of the relevance of having this kind of different kind of background? Some of them in the present context, I would say, is a photographic image. What was the problem that it gives? What was the relevance or the need for this kind of story behind the origin of different divinities?
If you take Ganapati, you know, there's nothing pornographic about him. You see, it's really very great fun, actually. And in Tamil Nadu, one of the representations of Pillaiyar in the villages is very simple, you know. They take a bit of cow dung, stick a few blades of fresh grass. They say, this is Pillaiyar, you see. I think the Ganapati is a very elaborate cult developed from primal agricultural origins. I didn't want to speak about this when I came here, you see. And then Subramanya, I mean, one has to study the hold of Subramanya, you know. It's a very important Tamil god, not only for the Brahmins, but for all sections of Hindu society. It is not only important here, but in Sri Lanka, you see. And in if you go in, I think it's either Thai Pusam or Panguni Uttaram, in Malaysia and Singapore. I mean, it's really the devotion which he inspires is awe-inspiring, you know. People stick lime into their skins, you know, stitch limes, and, you know, they really get into possession and so on. And one of the things, you know, somebody who is very interested should probably, it has already been done. I have seen a monograph or two, I haven't read it, on this Subramanyam cult in the Tamil region, you see, extending from South India and from Tamil India to right across Malaysia and so on, you see. And Subramanya takes, you know, these have cults which are, the point I want to stress is they have developed over centuries and even, you know, maybe 1,000 years.
The first thing that I was raising is both of them, the best of my knowledge, they are not particularly Buddhist, both of them are born to Lord Shiva and Bhagavad. One was in the form of a perfect human being, the other is a partly human being, partly animal. What was the need to have that kind of imaginative function?
No, I'll tell you, this you have to, I think you should take up a project and work on it, you see. There is a book by, I don't know if you'll get it, I studied it when I was a PhD student in Bombay, Rao Bahadur Gupte. Certainly you get it in the Bombay University Library, unless somebody has preferred it. It's called Hindu Festivals and Fasts. And Rao Bahadur Gupte's thesis is that Ganapati represents the triumph of agriculture over the forces antagonistic to agriculture, including wild animals, you see. And the head of the elephant is decapitated and it is placed on a human being. You know, you have to be deep in anthropological and psychological analysis of myth and legend to work out this, you see, no simple explanation. So it's the triumph of agriculture over the forces antagonistic to agriculture, you see. And Ganapati also sits on the absurd, this huge elephantine creature sits on a rat. And it's not an ordinary rat, it is a field rat, you see. And if you know the havoc which field rats do, you know, they steal away the paddy or other grain which agriculturists with great care grow. And every year during harvest, this is certainly true about 30 years ago, groups of wardas would fan out all over the agricultural region of South India. And they specialized in catching these field rats and taking away the grain with a groove, with a stole. And they would get, the owner of the land would pay them a certain sum because it was in his interest to reach these pests. They would eat the rats and consume the grain, and they also got a wage. The point is, the enemies of agriculture are symbolized in Ganapati. You see, this is, I think, as I remember, Rao Bahadur Gupte, you see. Regarding Ayyappan, you know, the pornography is in your eyes. It is not in the phenomena. Not your, I mean, the eyes of the person who sees. I think I have written long ago, I've written a short note on Ayyappan cult, you see. One of the things is, you know, if you read Gopinath Rao in Elements of Hindu Iconography, two or three volumes, there he deals with Ayyappan. Two elements, you know, which I remember, which I'll tell you. One is, it was also an attempt to incorporate Buddhism into Hinduism, you see, the challenge of Buddhism. That is one. And two, all over South India, the Shaivite Vaishnavite antagonism is too deep. It's very deep, you see. In fact, strict Sri Vaishnavas in the old days did not go to Shaivite temples. I mean, they would not, in parts of Maharashtra, Vaishnavites would not utter the term for sowing, it is said Siv. You know, Siv is sowing. They would not use the word Siv because accidentally they would be uttering the name of Shiva. So, the point is, the deity Ayyappan, Harihara Putran, is one way which folk Hinduism tried to get past the antagonism between Shaivites and Vaishnavites. This is a very tentative explanation. You have mentioned two or three areas, Murugan, Ganapati and Ayyappan. All these three things, you know, they make first class subjects for thesis, and that they have already been done for PhD in anthropology or sociology. Anybody is free to take them.
Thank you, Chairman.
My question is not the answer. I have tried to ask Hindu religion being tolerant religion. And in South, I was asking the same question to the party. Many Hindus who are tribal normally go to all the temples, but Vaishnavites stick to mainly Vishnu temples. Second thing is, even throughout India, if you ask, most of the Vaishnava temples are religious. And more
popular. No, you see, I'm very glad you asked the first question, because I have made great play of Hindu tolerance in my early portion of the lecture, and I have related it institutionally. There are ideological streaks of tolerance that you can't deny at all. At the institutional level, I thought somebody would pillory me on for that. You see, I've traced the source of tolerance to living in a caste society. The essence of caste society is you accept people who have other ideas than you. You say they are inferior, they say you are inferior. But basically you learn to live with each other. You know, and I have found, I mean, this is from my experience, at the village level, the other day, in fact, I wanted to make this point when Dr. Amita Thapar was saying, the interdependence between Muslims and Hindus is extraordinary. It's like a family, you see. It has all been, it's being disrupted. It has been disrupted ever since the last 50, 60 years. But such close interdependence, any one of you who wants to get an idea of it, please see my book, The Remembered Village, which is available as a paperback. So, at that level, there is tolerance. But then, what about intolerance? You know, I'm very glad you asked it. At the sectarian level, at the level of the sect, you get monotheism. And when you get monotheism, you also get intolerance. And it is not only, I think Sri Vaishnava Brahmins, I happen to be born one, were extraordinarily intolerant, you see. I mean, they won't go to Shaivite temples. But there is, in the mythology, the story of Ghantakarna, who is made out to be an ogre, you see, or a giant, or a rakshasa. And he went about with bells attached to his ears because he did not want to hear the name of Vishnu. So, sectarian intolerance was a feature of Hinduism. And cults like Ayyappan, Harihara Putran were attempts. They were southern in origin, you see. It's in the south that you get this antagonism, sectarian antagonism. It's in the south that you get attempts to overcome this, you know, through Harihara Putran and so on. So, and the other thing is, that's a good question. It's a very good question. Why are these Vaishnavite temples prosperous? I mean, take Tirupati, you see. Take Nathdwara and so on. I don't know. I think it's a good question. Once again, it should be. Somebody should work it out. One offhand, I would like to say, in Vaishnavite temples, you get prasad, you see. Shaivite temples, nothing. You get just ashes, literally, you see. Ashes and bilva, you see. So, and this whole, one of the things which Vaishnavism has done is to develop the concept of prasad. and you go to Brijbhumi. I think one of you may be from that area. And there the priests and the devotees roll over huge mounds of cooked rice and so on. You see, the concept of prasad, it's also in Assam, it's highly developed. You see, the concept of prasad is very highly developed in Hindu, in Vaishnavism. And you can go to Tirupati, you know, people go partly for laddus also. And you go to Madras, you see, at the Parthasarathi Koil, you have a tuck shop, you can buy all kinds of goodies. You go to the Kapaleshwar and you don't get anything like that, you see. And I think one way to get a good box office is to have a good refectory, you see, where you can serve people. I mean, this is a semi, you know, frivolous answer, but I do know that in Vaishnavism, the concept of prasad and partaking of the food offered to the god is a basic idea. It's extraordinarily developed, strangely enough, in that very in Assam, it's superficially obviously an area devoted to the worship of the mother goddess and to, you know, ringed around by tribes.
I wonder how too many there are a lot of ticket collectors.
It is not
so many that. Basically, the Hindu religion has attained throughout the country, but the practice of the traditional customs, the temple customs, they differ from Kashmir, North, South. Now, with this great geographical movement that is going on in the country, moving far away from the area that they come from, and they can't identify themselves, although they believe that happens and they are religious-minded, but they can't identify themselves when they go to the temple of that area. Or if they go to the street, local street, they can't identify the custom in which the religious performs the religious ceremony. I'm a yogi, I'm married to a Maharaj. Going away from the temple, they are religious and they believe in religion, but let us get away from this ceremony and customs that are going on. Do you think that this kind of migration that is taking place from one place to another would find the entire social structure of religion important? May I ask a question?
Now you see, between the two of you, you have asked many questions. I'll have to go one by one, you see. And I will feel my way. This difficulty, which highly westernized and educated Hindus are having with reference to temples, ritual outside their provenance, seems to be a phenomenon confined to them. I'll tell you why. Why should the number two headman of my village Rampura set out in 1940s, soon after the war ended? He was in his 50s, he set out on a pilgrimage. He got a chance, you know. I mean, you can imagine wartime third class train traveling conditions. Set out on a pilgrimage to certainly included Allahabad and Prayag and Benares. Probably it also involved Hardwar. And as he was about to leave the house, his daughter-in-law was very, very ill. And his son said, "Why don't you go on your pilgrimage after she recovers?" And this elderly man told him, "Look, I'll set out on a pilgrimage. Don't bother me with this trivia. If she dies, bury her or cremate her, but don't inform me. I will know about it after I come home. You see, what I am trying to stress is the importance of the faith, the strength of faith is one. Two, he was going to Hindu, this man told me, he was so parochial in his outlook, he told me that all beauty and intelligence ended with the frontiers of Mysore, outside the old princely state of Mysore. You know, I come from the princely state of Mysore, from the capital of the state, Mysore city. And he tells me, outside Mysore, you don't see beauty, you don't see intelligence and so on. This very, very parochial man, why should he go to Haridwar, certainly Allahabad and Benares and come back? And there they speak Hindi. And, you know, he may not even get cooked rice and so on, he will get chapati and so on. So, and my mother, you know, she was very moderately educated. She could speak a little English and so on. But they had a different attitude to pilgrimage shrines. When they went to Benares, they would say, in North India, how much milk is richer than here? How lush the vegetables, you see, the mulis, you know, this. And a kind of tourist element was added to devotion. Devotion always doesn't function as devotion only. But I think with education has come a fear of diversity. And this is, I think, you know, I am ideologically, I would like modern India to accept total diversity of this country. I mean, as I said, we have more diversity in India than probably Western Europe. You see. And each day, I'm thrilled to read about 6 weeks ago that they had discovered in the mountains of Madhya Pradesh a Jain deity, a statue to a Jain deity, which is 89 feet high. I mean, give me a few or give or take a few feet, you see. Before that, we believed that Bahubali in Shravan Barbara was the largest monolithic statue in India and in the world. But that beats it, you see. That is very, that's 1,000 years old, you see. Now, there is this tremendous diversity. And formerly we accepted diversity. We now seem to be rejecting diversity, you see. I don't know if it's a fair comment, you know. You will excuse me if I am being uncharitable. But, and the other thing is, then there is this thing. There is this great urge, populist urge, to know the meaning of the mantras which are being uttered, isn't it? I mean, that is one of the points you made. I find that, you know, I mean, I'm being perversely, particular, you know, deliberately perverse here. I think it's better that the mantras are in a language which is ancient and which you don't understand. Because if they are translated, they may say, may have 10 children or, you know, nowadays, particularly with family planning and so on, they are not good, I think. Whereas if it is in Sanskrit, which is sonorous, which you don't understand, all that you know is something very important is occurring. I think that is enough. Yeah, for chanting and the holy smoke, the ethos of the occasion. I mean, you need a sacred context. What you need is the idea of the sacred. I mean, it need not be spelled out to you in Kannada or Kashmiri or Marathi or Bengali or Hindi. I mean, this is I'm just saying this to provoke you. I partly believe in it. And the third thing which you mentioned about spirituality and anti-ritualism. There is in Hinduism both, I mean, Hinduism covered every kind of activity with ritual. But there is also a bhakti streak, which, I mean, it's not new. It's not new, at the same time it's new. In its pristine form, it's a rejection of Brahminical supremacy. It's a rejection of Sanskrit. It's a rejection of ritualism. It's an emphasis on the idea of devotion to an all-merciful, all-powerful God. And you know, this very deep streak in Hinduism. And this was revived by, during the 19th century, by the, you know, by the westernized Indians responding to the forces of, you know, missionary Christianity and so on. And you see it in Nehru, you see, he wants spirituality without, without ritualism and so on. I think it's a laudable idea, but to me, the Pharisee is very important for the sustenance of a religion. There should be priests, there should be temples, there should be ritualism and so on. They keep the religion going. A religion needs an institutional framework, you see. The mystic may reject it, but for the ordinary man, religion is not just spirituality. I mean, the religion, folk religion, is intimately bound up with the desire for children, with the desire for a good wife, with the desire for a good crop, with the desire that your son should pass the exams and so on and so forth. But the mystic and the renouncer want salvation. But there should be a kind of religious stream with people performing pilgrimages. I mean, not that there isn't room for reform here. There's plenty of room for reform here. Actually, in Hinduism, you can discard 90% of the religion and ritual and still maintain the religion going. But the idea that you can be spiritual and you can have pure meditation without a living religion, I somehow find it very difficult to accept.
But could I raise myself a two-part?
Great. Your first question was Ramakrishna. I think Ramakrishna mission arose out of a particular need of westernized, educated Indians for a national identity. And the fact that India and Hinduism were viciously being attacked by the missionaries. Every known evil in the world was in Hinduism. You name any evil, it is in Hinduism. It was in Hinduism on those days. Human sacrifice, banning of widow remarriage, child marriage. And you know, there were in Bengal, around 1850 or so, these Kulin Brahmins who used to go around the countryside marrying girls from so-called lower castes. The marriage was only symbolic. The Kulin would come here and he would marry a girl from this village. He would be paid an ample sum, feasted well and so on. And a few days later he would go to a neighboring village, marry a girl there. I think I have read cases of Kulins having 120, 130 wives. And they were so desirable as bridegrooms that big zamindars in eastern Bengal, Bangladesh, what is now Bangladesh, used to hijack them and get them married to their daughters. And they had latials, people with latis, and they would go in their boats, capture these fellows, bring them home, get them married, and then they would go. And when this fellow died, of course, he leaving behind 120 widows and so on. So this whole, one of the things which has to be studied, in the sociological history or social history of Western India is this linkage between a hypergamous setup in which you have to marry up the activities of the Kulins and innumerable child widows, particularly among the most visible sections of the society, the Bhadralok. And then Sati, this whole complex. And it was in this context, and at that time, you see, the modernist movement in Bengal is about 1830 or so, you see. Derazio and so on come, and they reject Hinduism, they say it's a stupid religion, and they celebrate their rejection in a peculiar way. I think many of you might know it, you see. They eat beef and drink whiskey, you see. This way. So, and then this nationalism develops, and I think Vivekananda was not only a mystic, he was a tremendous activist. And today the people who evoke Vivekananda, particularly, I'm not talking about the Ramakrishna mission, are the very elderly people. And he gave them self-confidence when the British came and missionaries came and ran down Hinduism and accused it of having every kind of evil in the world. Vivekananda said, we are the most spiritual people. And people still hail his speech at the Parliament of Religion. So, I would say Vivekananda became very relevant to Hindu upper caste living in urban areas in the years between 1960 or so. His relevance is, I would say is decreasing, but he is one of the nation's heroes now.
My question was slightly different, but because this urban Hinduism having sort of dissociated itself from the perennial concerns of the people, has it as a result weakened itself, weakened the Hinduism? And the militancy which we are seeing now in urban Hindu is a reaction to that sensing of the East.
So react. I think Dr. Kapoor, if I may say so, I would like to be dogmatic about it. It's also a response to what they call as minoritism. One of the symptoms of it is, I think all of you know that Ramakrishna Ashrama declared itself Ramakrishna Mission, that it was not part of Hinduism. Did you know? I think you know all that. They did that in order to obtain benefits which accrue to minority religions. You see. There is that feeling. Unfortunately, the constitution of India has created the feelings in many educated Hindus that they are second-class citizens. And the BJP is harping on it. And I think it is, it's a wicked, it may become more powerful in urban India. The BJP's present constituency, as I see it, is urban middle-class Hinduism, which is now anywhere between 100 to 150 million. And by the end of this century, 2000 AD, it will be about 300 million. So I would say this class of people are certainly not in touch with rural areas. But they are in touch with, they have their own needs and necessities, which is the Ramakrishna Mission, with the Sai Baba, and which Godmen answer, you see. And they are deeply troubled people. They have all kinds of problems. And there are not enough psychiatrists like Dr. Kapoor to go around ministering to their many needs and wants and sufferings, you see. So I would say the urban middle class has emerged as a very big lobby, and it has its own concerns. Maybe it is cut off from rural India. Even that I'm not sure. The same people will also go to Tirupati. Same people will go to Banaras. They will go to Sabarimala. One of the things that is, this country is a wonderful country for socialism. There aren't enough of them, you see. The way Sabarimala, Ayyappa cult is spreading in South India, it's fantastic, you see. Wait for about another 6 weeks. You see, suddenly you see a driver, an auto rickshaw man, wearing black going on, and then he goes through this 40 or 45 days of, vegetarianism and sleeping on the bare ground and going uphill and so on. Actually, the point I want to make is, when there is a deeply religious country, when there's a proliferation of cults, you get all kinds of cults. Even in Hinduism, traditional Hinduism, you got cults like Aghoripants, you see. And Anandamati is one of those. I don't know. No, I don't know if it's a dying movement. I don't know enough about it. I think it needs to be studied. Like the Rajneesh cult, you see. The point is, one of the things characteristic of our intelligentsia is, we don't think these are worth investigating. I think they have to be investigated, whether it's the RSS or the Rajneesh cult or Anandamargis and so on. You find there is far more curiosity about them in Chicago or in London or in Tokyo and so on. And same thing with Sai Baba. There's so many Singapore Chinese come to Sai Baba and Hong Kong Chinese come to Sai Baba. Why do they do it? You go to California, you see a Sai Baba society. What needs does this cult of Sai Baba answer?
Was there a kind of hierarchy of class among the gods? Suppose I was reading in the book, the excavation, either Shiva or Brahma, or eight or south, surrounded by the enemy, it was cast in arrows. But whenever the Vishnu remains was found, they were cast in gold. The explanation was given that Vishnu is the god of the rice.
God of the?
Rice. That's why Vishnu was sitting in the gold body. Whereas Pashupati or Brahma, whoever was the name, that was cast in arrows or stayed there. This indicates that possibly maybe Buddha is just the hierarchy of that, because the conception of God is better. The Shiva or Vishnu is not the God that comes to the hierarchy of that.
You see, I would like to put question marks because I don't know. Because you see, the way archaeological evidence is interpreted, you know, they say that there was linga worship in Mohenjo-daro. I'm not a student of Harappa and Mohenjo-daro. I was looking at some standard work on that. They found some, cylindrical objects and some rings. The archaeologists put them two together and said there was linga worship, you see. And what happens in these cases is you carry ideas from modern Hinduism and interpret the material through modern ideas, images and so on. I'm not saying all interpretation falls into this category, no. And there are people, I mean, Father Heras in Bombay said that he could interpret Mohenjo-daro script with the aid of modern Tamil and so on. I think these are, until we have a standard analysis of Mohenjo-daro, which is widely accepted by scholars, Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, we can't say anything. Because the picture you get from the Aryan end is that the Varna system, which is supposed to have given birth to Jati, which I don't believe, Varna system was a functional division of labor and not a hereditary division of labor, which would suggest a more egalitarian system.
Mr. Agnes,
there is a good deal of truth in your criticisms of Hinduism as you see it. I would not deny them. I was not dealing with, the drawbacks of Hinduism. You know, I could do a paper on that. I could give a long lecture on that. But the point I want to stress, there are one or two points, not in defense of the iniquities and the injustices of the system, but when we talk about Hinduism, as Romila Thapar would have said, we have to periodize it. You look at the Vedic period, early Vedas, you don't get these inequalities in such a strong form. As I now mentioned, the Sanskrit is, not only Indian Sanskrit, is Western Sanskrit is also now saying that Jati and Varna are different. Varna was a functional division of labor, which the early Aryans brought with them, you know, the priest, the ruler, soldier, and the ordinary man. This kind. And this developed with the development of agriculture, with the development of a settled society and so on. It developed, and as it spread over the whole of India, it became, jatis developed, and Varna and Jati, you know, became kind of mutually reinforcing system. And then, when you create a class of people who do not have the responsibility of working for their own livelihood, you make them priests and you give them privileges, and they become a literate class, they comment on the existing situation. They produce, you know, maybe the invention of writing, the invention of material on which to write on, and so on. You get a systematization of the system of the existing practices and beliefs. And Manudharma Shastra is one such extreme thing. It gained prestige among the learned Brahmins, and it got commentaries, you know, Apastamba and others developed commentaries and so on. And what you say about karma, samsara, etc. is true, but there is another side to it. One is, I have often asked the question, who obeyed what Manu said? See, we mustn't forget that though there were cities in ancient India and medieval India, these cities were very few and far between. Bulk of the people lived in villages. And how do we know that the writ of Manu, what he said about, you know, everything, the position of women, caste divisions and so on, applied in rural areas, you see. In this connection, I would like to refer you to a concept which an Africanist, Audre Richards brought out, called pedestrian states, you see. India was a series of pedestrian states, and the writ of the ruler ran only as far as the limits of the city. Even in 1920, in Mysore city, you know, Mysore was a developed city. I mean, villages living about 10 miles, 8 miles from Mysore, between that village and Mysore, if you had to travel by bullock cart, you ran a great risk to your life, you see, because their local groups took over. My own feeling is that the authority of the Brahmin was confined to a few cities and to a few great temple towns and monasteries. I don't think in the bulk of the country it ran very imperfectly. And you also see another thing, you see. If you look at the caste structure, the so-called lower castes have a much freer ethic and worldview than the upper castes have. Among them, marriage did not always take place before puberty. There were girls, I have seen in villages of Mysore, you know, girls 18, 19 among the peasant castes who were unmarried, who got married late, and if somebody had an extramarital alliance, it was not looked upon with the horror which it was looked upon among the upper castes and so on. So, I would look upon, you know, this as much more fluid and not everybody obeying these things and so on. Even karma and samsara, and when you talk about karma, particularly I found, people talk about it to explain a disaster which has happened, not as a guide to future action, you know. This is one of the things I have discovered. And explaining a disaster which has happened by reference to fatalism is one way of facing the future. Probably our idea of what is religion should change. I mean, religion and values. You know, when you look at religion, you probably look at the purusharthas, you see. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha.
dharma being the overarching value, and ultimately it's, you know, still more overarching is moksha. But that is a very elite and artificial conception of religion. A much more down to earth. If you go to the Srirangapatam temple, Ranganatha temple, which even Tipu worshipped that, you see. And then what do? You see the image of Krishna there. Women go and apply butter to his image and lick a little of the butter because they want a son. So religion as applying to salvation is one idea. I'm not saying it's an illegitimate idea. But religion as a survival institution is bound up with the day-to-day concerns of ordinary people. So, I mean, this idea, separating religion from the concerns of the people, is a very elitist idea. The first question I didn't... I think the two are separate. I mean, people have anxieties, you see, whether they have children, whether their husband will recover from a well, you know, my husband might want his wife to recover from a very serious illness. The wife might want the husband to recover, might get a better job and so on. They go on pilgrimages, they go to godmen, they go to astrologers, they go to magicians and so on, you see. I think reason, you know, certainly in your laboratory you use reason. When I'm writing a paper, I use reason. But to think that reason should dominate the totality of human life is a modern idea, I think.
And George?
I don't know if I'm making sense, you see.
You could continue on this later on.
Yeah? Comment on it. Why should you take, I mean, this applies to both Mr. George and you, why should you take the model of Christianity or Islam or Judaism and then say Hinduism is not a religion? Why can't you take the model of Hinduism as you have put it and say that these are funny religions, Islam, Christianity and Judaism? No, the point I'm making is no, the what's wrong with it? Why should I define it? I mean, all these Brahminical concerns I put aside. What do the people do is my basic test. And why should I take a missionary's idea of what a proper religion is and then say mine is not a proper religion? I mean, you see, doesn't it show a colonial dominated mind? Yes?
There's a question.
There is no reference to the Hindu reality. The concept of Hindu came in the writings of Arabic to refer to the Hindu Al-Hind, the land beyond the river,
supposing this name came to us from the Arabs or the Greeks or somebody else from the Eskimos. And here are millions of people worshipping Ganesha, worshipping the village goddess, worshipping the Nandi bull, the symbol of agriculture and so on, worshipping all kinds of gods and goddesses. And they have priests called Brahmins. They have also priests in other castes. That's forgotten. You know, ex-untouchables have priests, and during the festival of the village deity, for 10 or 11 days, they go through the most austere rituals, etc. They fast, they are vegetarians, teetotalers, they may not sleep, and they are possessed by God, they walk on fire, they lacerate themselves and so on. And if a missionary comes and tells me, this is not religion, only if you believe in Yesu, or a Muslim, good Muslim comes and tells me, only if you believe in, incidentally, Muhammad is not God, Allah is God, and Christ is not God, Christ is the Son of God, you see. They have their theologies, they have their beliefs, why shouldn't Hindus have their own beliefs? And mind you, these beliefs also, from the Vedic age to medieval India and today, they are changing. That is the mark of a live religion. What's wrong with it? I mean, the point is, Indian intellectuals have placed themselves on the defensive as a result of colonial rule of 150 years. I'm not saying that they should defend everything you are doing, and you know, just as in Parliament, you practice so many laws, let us, an assembly of Indians, let us say, you know, we ban, I mean, child marriage is an evil, sati is an evil, and so on. That is a different thing. Every religion has, you know, if we had caste system, Christianity produced slavery, you see. I mean, let's not forget that. And Islam also produced slavery because the Arabs were early slavers.